Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts for podcast 595. Going to get your week started out because there's a lot going on. We're back in a news-rich environment, and I want to talk about our money, our economy, as well as some of the developments over the weekend with Trump's executive order on travelers from certain countries. We'll talk about the controversy and the money in this podcast, podcast 595. Now, if you're looking for an SUV, listen up, because I'm going to tell you where you can get an SUV that is fabulous, and that is xgovernmentcars.com, Minnesota's only dealer specializing in one-owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks, and SUVs. I was talking to Ed this week, and he said, Ed Johnson, the owner of xgovernmentcars.com, he's got a line on Homeland Security and Border Patrol SUVs that have very low mileage. I was out there in the fall and saw an Expedition late fall that was so clean, I thought it was brand new. So, you know, if you can get one that's low mileage, I have a Crown Vic that I got that had low mileage that has been the best car I probably ever owned. So we're talking about Expeditions, we're talking about Yukons. And of course, they still have the Dodge Chargers and they have the Ford Police sedans and the Ford Police SUVs and the Crown Vics while they last. But if you're looking for low mileage trucks, SUVs that have been sitting in garages primarily, that's at least the case with the FBI truck that I saw, then you need to check out xgovernmentcars.com. If you need an SUV and you need a loan and you have a job, you can get approved. And of course, X Government Cars takes trades. They pay the highest values every day without all the bull. They also have the 3-day peace of mind guarantee exclusively at X Government Cars. So here's what you do. First, you can go online and check out the selection, or you can get your butt down to X Government Cars, now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North, or call them 763-777-8782.
X Government Cars.
Well, we're going to talk about money in this podcast. And I say money because it's kind of a dumbed down title that works on the internet. It's really about the economy. But if you put a title up and call it economy, it's not going to get as many clicks as money. So I decided to use money. So we're going to talk about money. And this podcast is a podcast that I'm doing completely off the top of my head, no notes, kind of an easy talker about this because I think the situation calls for just to talk and not a dense podcast in that I've researched that I'm rushing to get certain information out to in the podcast because I've researched it, right? So this is an easy talker about money, and the reason is money is at the root of many of the problems of this country right now. But I do want to say, before we jump into this, this president has been in office for roughly 2 weeks, right? And he is kicking up an awful lot of dust with executive actions and with media comments and everything else. And there's a lot to say about it. I don't want to spend a whole podcast talking about it, but I am going to say this. I am not going to fall into the trap of defending a particular action by the president or actually attacking a particular action by the president, because all that you see in the media this weekend, as I'm recording this in podcast time, it's the weekend of the executive order on foreign travel from a series of nations, which include people of Muslim descent living in them. 80% of the countries, the Muslim countries, are not, of course, included in the executive order. I've read the executive order, and it seems to me the biggest problem with this order has to do with whether or not you can deny someone who is here legally their rights that they get when they are here legally without due process. That seems to be the issue with the courts that have issued stays in direct relation to people who are kind of trapped at airports. And there have been protests, and there's an immediate and negative reaction to almost everything this president has done. But what there isn't right now is too many people defending President Trump. And now I would be expecting the people who voted for Trump to be defending Trump and defending everything that he wants to do and defending him vociferously. But I don't see that. I don't see counter protests at the airport by Trump supporters. Maybe we will. But I said this when he was running. I said to Republicans in particular, the problems are going to come not if Trump loses, but if he wins. If he wins, then you're going to have problems because you're going to have to defend him. Now, it wasn't too long ago that a Republican president ended up depending on talk radio and punditry to defend his actions in Iraq, and was almost unable to go out and defend himself for various reasons. So the trap that we commentators and we people who are supposed to be doing information-type programming, whether it's podcast or on the radio, it's easy to fall into the trap of saying, well, I think this is a good order and this is the reason for it. And, you're put in a position of defending somebody when everybody is all up in arms. So I'm going to talk very quickly about the nature of what he is doing politically and why this is a particularly difficult thing the country to understand, and why it's a particularly difficult thing for the media to understand. I talked about a little bit in the radio show, and that is that the media in our country is based almost entirely upon reaction. They don't do a lot of investigative reporting. They aren't very balanced when it comes to trying to figure out what actually is happening. They tend to go for the lurid. They tend to go for the visual. They tend to go with opinion pieces. Hence, you will see a piece on Politico which attacks the order, which people will assume is a news story. So there's all that kind of stuff. So then what happens is the supporters and people in the administration and people in the same party as the president have to defend this. Now, it almost goes without saying that Democrats never said a word about Obama's executive orders, and Republicans attacked them almost consistently. Suddenly now you have a president who is using executive orders. It seems like this is what he does. It seems like he's trying to run the country by fiat. And Republicans are defending it, the same action that they attacked Obama for doing. And Democrats are, attacking the idea of presidents usurping power from Congress using executive orders. This particular executive order, as the executive orders which gagged the Park Service and the EPA a week or so or two ago that kicked up a whole bunch of complaints and dust in social media, he is well within his boundaries in terms of issuing executive orders which determine how departments of the federal government in the executive branch are run. Where he's running afoul of judges is in this question of whether or not, as I said, people who are here legally can be denied their constitutional rights, the rights that are extended to them, even if they're visiting without due process, meaning without without a court's decision. So they're going to have to figure that out, and they're going to have to either amend the executive order or issue a new one. But let's just put it this way. Someone tonight, where I was hanging out somewhere tonight, and somebody remarked, "Boy, I've never felt like this before. I've never felt like I was completely disconnected from the decisions that my government was making." Now, this person is obviously probably not a Trump supporter, right? And so there's probably a lot of people in the Democratic Party and a lot of people on the left who are suddenly experiencing this disconnect, where a majority government that they don't agree with, so House, Senate, President, are making decisions that go are at odds with the things that they think should be done. And so suddenly they're saying, "I've never felt this disconnected from my government doing things." I tried to explain to somebody last night. I had a long argument with somebody last night about this, and I tried to explain there are a number of people in this country who believe strongly that the border issues, whether it is people coming from countries which are war-torn and potentially terrorists, and I'm not defending Trump, I'm just saying this is what I hear, this is what I heard when I toured the whole country. It's what I hear from people who don't live in city centers and don't live in urban centers, who don't live in liberal suburban close-in villages, but who are from different parts of the country. They feel that the previous president was lax on border control and lax on security, and they want someone to handle this. And this is what he is doing. And he promised he would do it. If you don't agree with it, it's understandable. If there are legal problems with it, constitutional problems with it, and the way that he's doing it, it's going to have to be addressed. But he is not going to wait to do these things. So, you know, the question I have is how long people can stay aroused about the same issue when he's changing and moving along and doing different things almost every day. Because I'm doing this podcast on a Sunday night. I'm sure by Tuesday, if not Monday morning, there will be a whole new thing that everyone is upset about. So how long will people remain upset? So what he's doing is he is basically inside the decision-making cycle of people who oppose him and throwing out consistently new things before they have a chance to fully react and before the media has a chance to really try to figure out what's going on. For example, the court rulings, which have to do with whether or not you can take someone's civil rights away who is here legally. And that's a legal question. I'm not an attorney. You know, I've read the executive order, but I don't presume to tell you whether or not it's right, wrong, or the right thing or anything else. I'm just saying there are a number of people that supported Trump for president that feel strongly that this is a good thing. We're not hearing from them, which is interesting to me because, you know, they were very vocal about telling me why he would be better than Hillary Clinton, let's say. But suddenly when he's, you know, hitting the weeds a little bit, you don't see any of these Trump people out defending him. And by the way, the administration or the Republican Party is sending out emails asking for people to do things to defend him. But I have, you know, if you have by now, great. But I haven't seen any stuff this weekend about people defending President Trump for the executive order, especially in the face of very harsh criticism from what I would consider to be fairly urban, fairly center-left people who don't like what he's doing. Now, one more thing. So given the support that this president has, which, you know, it is what it is, given the people who supported this president, given the things that they expect to be done, because the next big steps are going to be taken on the border, and that's going to kick up all kinds of dust, and people are going to be all angry about that. People need to understand that doing these things in a country that for so long, for at least the last 8 years, and I would argue that for a good part of the Bush administration, pussyfooted around key issues, suddenly doing things that are very, very controversial is going to produce a big reaction. Is it politically smart? That remains to be seen. If he kicks up too much reaction, maybe it's negative, but it may also be positive in that it's drawing attention to his actions and pulling in people to support him. Remember, the vote in 2016 was a big surprise to people on the left. You heard people say, I don't know anyone who voted for Trump. And that's, you know, kind of funny considering the fact that obviously people did vote for him in places like Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin and some other supposed Democrat strongholds like Pennsylvania, right? So it remains to be seen whether these things are politically viable or not, both for President Trump in 2020, as well, and most importantly, for Congress in 2018. And that cycle is beginning as we speak. These guys are already going out trying to raise money as we speak. So the 2018 cycle, although it's relatively silent right now, because the coverage is all on what Trump is doing, has already begun. And candidates are already preparing to run. So all of Congress has to run in 2018, and a good number of senators. The bad news for Democrats is that in this particular sweep in 2018, they're going to be defending an awful lot of seats versus going after seats that Republicans are defending. And we'll talk about that more in the future when we start talking about 2018. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you this is a good thing. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that Trump should have done this or shouldn't have done this. That's up to him to explain to the American people why he is doing the things he's doing. And it's up to the people who supported him to explain why he is doing the things he's doing. But that is what is going on. And I think This, I would refer to it as OODA looping. It's the OODA loop that was developed by a famous, you know, U.S. fighter pilot, Observe. What is it? Observe. I can't remember what OODA loop means. Observe, orient, decide, react. In other words, what you're doing is you are gearing your, it's a tactic or a strategy that is geared to keeping your opponent completely confused because you are observing what they do. You're reacting, you're deciding to what they do, and then you are acting based on their reaction. And I think that's what the I think that's the strategy with Trump, to keep doing things that confuses the left, to keep them on the back of their heels. So how many things can George Soros invest in terms of you know, paying for people to start groups and paying for protesters and things of that nature? We'll see. This is all stuff we'll have to see going forward. Now, what I want to talk about in this podcast is what I think the biggest issue is going to be once we clear these initial few weeks, because once Congress gets rolling and gets working on initiatives that he's either going to sign or stuff that he wants that they are going to supposedly send him, then we're going to get into the economic questions. And I want to take the high ground a little bit and talk a little bit for 10, 15 minutes about the money issues in this podcast. Well, it is February, or very close to it. It's hard to believe that it's almost February. I don't know whether, I can't tell whether January went by super fast or super slow. It's weird. But part of it was we had this warm weather, which is great, but it's going to get cold again. And when it does, that means the possibility that you're going to have plumbing and heating problems. That's why I have been telling people to remember Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for home or business emergencies. Because when it comes to keeping all these systems running right, especially these days, you got to have somebody who is dedicated to quality service. And they've been doing quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems at Ryan for four generations. So they have reliable emergency service. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. You call 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 metro-wide from St. Paul. So they got plumbers that can get to you in the suburbs if you have emergency needs. Right now when it's warm, it's not that big of a deal, but every time it gets cold, I got to run a bead of water, and you might have problems out in the street. You might have problems someplace where a pipe bursts. That has happened to me. Remember Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul for emergency service, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 metro-wide from St. Paul, and that means the suburbs too for four generations. Ryan Plumbing and Heating. I'll have a little coffee. I just made a great dinner. I love bacon and eggs for dinner occasionally. So I just made a huge, I didn't make a huge pot of coffee. I've got this giant mug that is almost like a pot of coffee. So I fill this up with coffee and then I sit and I do a podcast and I drink it. It's wonderful. Probably not the best thing for the voice, but excuse me, who cares? So a few weeks ago, I talked in a podcast about somebody had posted on somebody's Facebook page. The fourth quarter economic numbers came out, and they were pretty good, and the president was ballyhooing them, and you know, this is when Obama was still president, and they were saying, you know, that he did such a good job with the economy. Now, no reasonable person thinks that, but in any case, they were using these fourth quarter numbers. What has happened over the past, well, I would say since the financial crisis of 2008, is that consistently we have had what first the president called them green shoots. Other people had different names for them, but you'd have a quarter or two of 2.5 to 3 or 4, sometimes even, well, I guess 3.5, maybe even 4% economic growth. Then those numbers would be revised down. And as far as I know, I don't think he broke 1.5% economic growth for his entire presidency. And people have all sorts of explanations for that. You know, he inherited a financial crisis, and we've been digging out all this time after that. But I just think it's important to point out that we've lost, we've essentially lost, you know, a decade. We've got a lost decade of very slow economic growth in this country. And my own personal feeling is when you have 1.5% to 1.5 to 1% economic growth for extended periods of time, that's something that you can feel. You know, I'm old enough to remember what the early 80s felt like when the economy grew robustly, literally robustly. They used that term robust. The president, President Obama, used that term robust a couple of times. But robust is 5+%. I mean, robust economic growth is something that you can feel. And we were talking about this the other night at dinner. We were talking about how back in those days, people didn't even worry about having a job, because you could get a job pretty easily. And it happened pretty quickly. We went to 82, 83, things really started to pick up, and interest rates were still high, but they were coming down. They were high compared to now, but they were coming down from 18, 19%. Inflation was coming down, and things were getting better really fast, and you could feel it. You could feel people's optimism. You could hear it in the music. You could see it. It was something that was palpable. So this guy made this comment when they initially released the economic numbers that said that the fourth quarter of 2016 was great. Said, oh yeah, you know, they revised the numbers up as though it's a conspiracy. Well, they just revised the numbers down, and 2016 turned out to be 1.5% economic growth. Each GDP issuance from the National Bureau of Economic Research, I think is where they come from, go through two or three revisions. I think they go through at least three revisions every time. And they always revise because new information comes in and they always revise. They don't revise on demand, as far as my experience. They revise when they get new information, and it's usually three or four times. So we had just finished this last year of the Obama administration and the last year of Democrat policies, economic policies, and we have very, very nominal growth. 1.5%, I would think, is statistically probably not even – we probably have roughly 0% economic growth. And you can say it's 2%, or you can say it's 0%, you can say it's 1%. Spikes usually occur because Boeing sold a bunch of airplanes or because CAT, you know, built a plant somewhere, things of that nature. Very, very slow economic growth. So the chief problem after Trump stops grandstanding and doing things with executive orders is going to be working with Congress to develop economic policies that grow the economy. This is why people voted for him. They thought he was going to make America great. And I want to say a couple of things before the fireworks start, because there's going to be a lot of fireworks on economics. You're going to see a lot of headlines about things that he wants to do. The first spate of headlines involve trade protection, which is never a good idea, because why? Trade deals generally are negotiated and signed because our trading partners historically have been trade protectionists and the United States has not. So the whole idea of trade agreements is to get countries to drop their trade barriers to us, as opposed to us dropping our trade barriers to them. Now, there's differences opinions about this. Some people think we got the stinky end of the stick when it comes to some of these deals. Others disagree with that. They are very complex documents. You would have to have a degree in foreign relations and economics to understand some of them, not to mention being a legal authority. So when people talk about NAFTA, when people talk about TPP, when people talk about WHO, that's the World Health, the WTO rather, the World Trade, organization or regime. When people talk about trade zones like the European Union, you know, you're talking about agreements that took years to negotiate. They're very long and involved and complex. So I love hearing from people that obviously have never read NAFTA, for example, how we've got to get rid of NAFTA. It's ruining the country, that we need to do something about that. Very quickly, I've said it very, very many times, and I will say it again. Most of the jobs in the United States that are in manufacturing have been lost due to information technology and robotics and automation. They have not been lost due to overseas. We didn't just box all those jobs up and send them to China. As one person recently put it to me, do you want to manufacture for something for $18 or do you want to manufacture for $2 an hour? Because that's the difference between overseas trade or trade in Mexico, you know, manufacturing in Mexico and sending it up here. That's not going to go away. So trade protection is dangerous because it forces companies to bring stuff back to the United States. Everybody thinks, I think, that if we bring all this stuff back to the United States, that that will produce all sorts of factory jobs. But the truth is that a lot of these new factories that are being built, you're hearing these stories that Ford's building a plant in Detroit and BMW is going to build a plant and companies are bringing their plants back to the United States because of these reasons. And these factories, the new factories, are very, very much robotic-oriented. They're automated, most of them, so they don't produce the same number of jobs. Keep in mind that while all these manufacturing jobs have been killed in the United States, manufacturing has been increasing, and we actually produce more now than we ever did. So our manufacturing output is still, really good. The first thing I want to point out, that don't expect trade protection to do anything other than to make goods in the United States more expensive. So if you want to buy that pressure cooker from Walmart that's $11 right now, that electronic pressure cooker that everybody's talking about, that might end up being $30 because of that. So would you still buy it? Well, you know, if it adds $2,000 or $3,000 to the cost of a certain type of car that you want to buy, would you still be interested in buying it? And so forth. So I don't think trade protection is going to produce economic growth. That's the first thing. The second thing is, he talks about cutting corporate taxes, which is, I think, a good idea. I personally don't believe there should be any corporate tax, because corporations are vessels and they pass taxes right on through to the consumer. So if you want to reduce the price of things, eliminating corporate taxes would be a good idea. But I personally think we need a completely new tax system in this country that's either based on a flat tax that you have to pay at the end of the year, that you don't go and get a tax return and they don't take it out, they don't take withholding out. You have to pay your tax at the end of the year that's based on a flat rate or some sort of consumption tax, as long as we get rid of all other taxes. This is all stuff that has to be done through Congress. This isn't stuff that can be done through executive orders, by the way. So this is a congressional issue. This is, you know, the full milieu of congressmen, Democrat and Republican, liberals and conservatives, you know, rhinos and, libertarians, the whole, you know, bunch. So this is a huge piece. Reducing corporate taxes is good, and it might help corporations make more money, which doesn't necessarily create jobs. And then finally, the thing I think I'm most worried about is this idea that we're going to spend $1 trillion to build roads and bridges and airports and infrastructure that will help economic growth. The theory is that the highways that were built produced economic growth, and that the ports that were built, going back to the B&O Canal, that helped commerce, and that's something that's a public space that the federal government should spend money on, and that will produce a high multiple. That's the term that's used. That you spend on these things, it will have a high multiple, both in terms of the people that build these things, and secondarily, and more importantly, the amount of commerce that's created around these new airports or whatever it is that you want to build. The problem is government spending, especially at that level and that much money, that high amount, is very difficult because it has to be block granted to states and it becomes political and you end up building latrines at National Guard bases and doing things that aren't necessarily going to have a high multiple. So I think that's a bad idea. The United States budget deficit and the United States public debt are the two biggest, I think, economic problems that we have related to government. Secondly, this idea that we need to tax the rich. And thirdly, the idea that that another middle-class tax cut is going to cause economic growth. You know, middle-class taxes are historically low. So it's important that people think about this stuff going forward, because when they get into economic policy, what I'm afraid is going to happen is we're going to get a polyglot economic policy that's very Keynesian that probably won't work. And this is one of the problems with the last 6 to 8 years, where you had nominal economic growth because it was based on government spending. Government spending generally is just taking water from the deep end of the pool and pouring it into the shallow end of the pool. And I'll say this to close, because the economy is, I believe the economy, and I'm with the people that believe the economy is a force of nature, like a storm. You know, we are the economy. It's the millions and millions of transactions that you and I make every day, that I decided not to go to the store tonight and to go home and eat bacon and eggs, as opposed to going to the store and getting a steak and having that. There are millions and billions, perhaps trillions, of transactions made every day by individuals that we can never track and never know. So if you get more people making more transactions, then you get economic growth. Things that the government does generally don't affect economic growth. I think the biggest problems that we have are things like, for example, well, I should amend that, because that's not really fair to say that. Things the government does can hurt economic growth. They've increased the cost of medical insurance. With penalties going up, people, you know, $600 is a lot of money, let's say, to a family of four to pay in penalty if they don't have health insurance. And paying for health insurance at increased rates because of Obamacare is a huge problem. There are all sorts of regulations that add charges to things. People are requested to get licenses for things. Cities, towns, and counties have all sorts of regulations that adds cost to providing services and making things and doing things. That if we can clear away this thicket of excessive regulation, these are the things that can spur economic growth. And the question is whether that's going to get done, or whether instead they're going to pass a Republican $1 trillion stimulus package. So I'm not necessarily optimistic about what is planned in Washington to fix our money, so to speak. In other words, our economy. And going ahead, this is probably going to be quite an argument, because there's a huge number of people that believe that what we have to do is tax the rich, take that money and give it to poor people, and everything will be okay. We have to tax corporations at higher rates, take that money and help people, and everything will be okay. Well, you have a new administration that supposedly doesn't feel that way. But what they want to do is take a certain amount of federal money and, companies, and get investment and get up $1 trillion so that they can start building new airports. Time will tell whether this works or not. So I'm dubious of Trump's economic plan, whatever it is, and really dubious of what Congress will do with it. So between the executive orders and the potential for them to screw up an economic plan, and we'll see what happens when we actually get the pudding. So the proof's in the pudding. And if it works, it works. But let me just say, this is why I said to Republicans, you may rue the day that this may be the last Republican president, that this may end up foundering the party. Because I don't see an economic philosophy, a money philosophy, that's necessarily going to work. We'll see. Certainly, part of this discussion of trade protection and economic growth is going to have to do with companies asking themselves whether or not they want to start thinking about moving manufacturing back to the United States, because there's going to be a lot of pressure on companies to do that. It's in the news with all the talk about foreign manufacturing with the new president. Some companies are preparing to bring some of their manufacturing back to the United States. If you work for one of those companies, if your company is considering American manufacturing, remember DepoStar, American design, engineering, and manufacturing. Visit their website at depostar.com. Remember, when it gets cold, think Ryan Plumbing and Heating for quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. Obviously, AC is not going to be a problem when it's cold, but burst pipes and plumbing problems due to cold weather. Emergency service, Ryan Plumbing and Heating, 651-224-4771, or in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Metro-wide from St. Paul, Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Check them out online at ryanplumbing.com. Also, don't forget xgovernmentcars.com has a line on those low mileage SUVs from Homeland Security and the Border Patrol. They're awesome. Just check them out online at xgovernmentcars.com or visit xgovernmentcars.com by getting your butt down to X Government Cars in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North.
xgovernmentcars.com.
All right, you guys, thanks a lot for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast, podcast 595, almost to 600 on iTunes, and subscribing on iTunes and listening to the audio feed right off the BobDavisPodcast.com homepage and subscribing to the podcast right off the homepage or listening on Stitcher.com. Tune in. I appreciate the likes and the shares and so forth on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, especially my favorite social media, because there's no snarking and not much political crap. And thanks for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command. I'll tell you more about plans for travel coming up at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening.